From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk politics from the Vietnam War to the Bush presidency with Hendrik Hertzberg, a political writer for The New Yorker magazine. He's also a former editor of The New Republic and was a speechwriter for President Carter. His new book, Politics, collects his writings from 1966 to 2004. Also, music critic Milo Miles tells us about a group of hip-hop DJs from New York called The Executioners. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. A powerful car bomb in Baghdad killed 11 people today. 40 others were wounded, including one U.S. soldier. NPR's Philip Reeves says the bombing occurred at a checkpoint.
The blast occurred close to the entrance of the Green Zone, which is a sprawling area on the banks of the Tigris River, which houses, among other things, the U.S. Embassy and the headquarters of many foreign contractors and the Iraqi interim government. In this area, there usually are a number of people on any given day. It's an area where Iraqis queue up either to go in and work in the area or recently to seek jobs in the area.
NPR's Philip Reeves in Baghdad. Iraq's interim prime minister is vowing to catch those responsible for the attack. He says the bombing may be related to this week's roundup of more than 500 criminal suspects in Baghdad. Also in Iraq today, the provincial governor of Mosul was killed in an attack on his convoy, and the Philippines said it will remove 51 peacekeepers to satisfy demands of kidnappers who are threatening to execute a Filipino truck driver. The U.S. said the Philippine move sends the wrong message. President Bush is swinging through Wisconsin today on a campaign bus trip. It's part of a Midwest tour that also included Minnesota and Michigan. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
Wisconsin had the third narrowest margins in the 2000 elections after Florida and New Mexico. That puts it at dead center of Republicans' target for this campaign season. Mr. Bush is traveling with Health and Human Services Secretary and Wisconsin native Tommy Thompson.
Wisconsin is the state that eagles soar, Harleys roar, Packers score, and we'll give Bush four more.
Thompson and Mr. Bush rallied some 5,000 voters in Waukesha County with a message of economic growth and national security. The president's campaign bus then wound through rural Wisconsin towns on roads lined with waving citizens. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, traveling with the president in Wisconsin.
Democratic vice presidential candidate John Edwards was on the campaign trail also today. Edwards said British Prime Minister Tony Blair took responsibility for problems with intelligence in a report released today. He said President Bush had failed to do the same with a recent critical Senate report on intelligence used to justify the Iraq War. And he said Kerry would behave differently as John Kerry would behave differently as president.
What we need in the White House is somebody who has the strength, courage, and leadership to take responsibility and be accountable not only for what's good, but for what's bad. That's what John Kerry will be.
Edwards spoke in Des Moines, Iowa. Today, the Dow Industrials lost 38 points to close at 10,208 in heavy trade. The Nasdaq Composite was down 16, closing at 1914. This is NPR News. A proposal to amend the Constitution to ban same-sex marriage failed to get enough votes to move forward to formal consideration by the Senate today. The amendment, backed by President Bush and Republican leaders, needed 60 votes out of 100, but it only got 48, with six Republicans joining the vote against. Republican Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama said he does not think the issue is going away after today's vote. President Bush expressed disappointment with the result. Democratic presidential candidate Senator John Kerry skipped the vote. He accused Republicans of trying to change the Constitution for political gain and said the important work of government was not getting done. A member of the commission charged with investigating U.S. intelligence failures is stepping down. Washington attorney Lloyd Cutler says he's leaving the nine-member panel for personal reasons. NPR's Mary Louise Kelly reports.
Lloyd Cutler has been a fixture on Washington commissions and advisory boards for years. He's a former White House counsel to Presidents Carter and Clinton, and now at age 86, he's said to be stepping down for health reasons. His replacement on the panel is Walter Slocum, a highly regarded former Undersecretary of Defense. Slocum has already begun work. He's attending the commission's latest set of meetings this week. A commission spokesman says the subject is signals intercepts and that commissioners are interviewing officials from the National Security Agency. President Bush appointed the panel back in February to investigate intelligence on weapons of mass destruction. Its final report is due in March, the last of several high-profile investigations into the state of U.S. intelligence gathering. Mary Louise Kelly, NPR News, Washington.
I'm Paul Brown, and this is NPR News in Washington.
The NPR shop introduces the limited edition NPR Tivoli Model 1 radio, designed by Henry Kloss for both performance and simplicity, available at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Hendrik Hertzberg, has been a staff writer and editor at The New Yorker since 1992. He often writes Talk of the Town pieces. The magazine's editor, David Remnick, describes Hertzberg as, quote, the principal political voice of The New Yorker. It is a remarkable voice, at once courteous and ferocious, seductive and caustic, tender and urbane, unquote. Hertzberg has also been an editor at The New Republic and worked as President Carter's chief speechwriter. His new book, Politics, collects his essays from 1966 to 2004, beginning with an article about the new hippie subculture, ending with articles analyzing the presidency of George W. Bush. Reading your book made me feel like I was watching, in part, my life and in part, you know, the history, the recent history of America flash before my eyes. I'm wondering what it was like for you to collect all of this and reread it.
Well, it's a pretty amazing experience. I've always been a sprinter as a writer. And so the great missing piece was a book. And this came along, and this is a way to have a book without actually having to write it. You just sort of accumulate it over a lifetime. And it was like seeing your life flash before you, to go through these things from way back. I mean, from when I was a kid, because to put the book together, I went farther back than there's stuff here in the book. I mean, I went back to the Hertzberg Times, the family newspaper I put out as a child.
No,
I went
kidding.
Back to the Mountain Echo, this high school newspaper for which I interviewed John Coltrane.
Wow. I
tried to keep too much of the juvenilia out of there, but there's still a bit in there.
Well, one of your early pieces in your new collection, Politics, is on the Weather Underground, and this is from February of 1970 for Wynn Magazine. Mm-hmm. And reading about the Weather Underground made me think about how the expression the far left has changed in meaning. At the time that you wrote this, the left was maybe the anti-war movement, or maybe SDS, but the far left was the militant group, the Weather Underground. Now, some people are using the far left to describe people like, you know, John Kerry. Do you think how do you see the meaning of far left as having changed the way it's commonly used?
Well, it's changed partly for polemical reasons and partly for real objective reasons. There is no active far left in the sense that there was in the late 1960s. There is no equivalent that I know of the Weather Underground, unless you count groups, some of the more extremely militant environmental groups. The real equivalent of the Weather Underground is now on the right. It's it's the militias and the kind of people who blew up the building in Oklahoma City. And the left was actually a much larger conglomeration in the 60s. We don't really have that kind of a left now. Now I would say, if you talk about the far left, maybe you talk about Michael Moore. To characterize John Kerry as being the far left or even left is just a polemical name-calling. He's a liberal, and even that he might be uncomfortable with.
And how do you think the word liberal has changed in meaning?
It's been diabolized by the right, unfortunately. It's a wonderful, perfectly good word. It's rooted in liberty, It has changed so much that if you go back to 1952, when Richard Nixon gave his acceptance speech at the Republican convention when he was nominated for vice president, the whole beginning of his speech was an argument that the Republicans, that he, Nixon, and Eisenhower, and the Republicans were the real liberals. In those days, liberal was a word that everybody wanted to have attached to them, and even Robert Taft would pay homage to that word. I think it was a mistake for liberals to let go of that word. I think it's a much better word than, say, the word progressive, because liberty is a better value than progress in my book.
Since your new book starts with articles you wrote about hippies in San Francisco and the weather underground, and the divisions in the country, then I'm interested in how you see the so-called culture wars of today as comparing with the cultural and political divide in the late 60s and early 70s. Do you think that the issues and the values dividing the country have changed between the 60s and today?
Absolutely. And in the same way that the political spectrum, you might say, has shifted tectonically to the right, that's been widely noted, that the positions that Richard Nixon took in the 60s would now be too far left for Democrats in the aughts. But by the same token,
Wait, did you say too far left for Democrats?
For Democrats today, yeah. I mean, Richard Nixon had a program for universal health insurance. I mean, the Nixon domestic policy now, if you take some of it, which never got enacted, but a minimum income, universal health insurance, some of these things that Nixon went along with. I mean, he wouldn't have gone along with them if there hadn't been overwhelming public support for them. But that whole spectrum, the whole spectrum of politics, has shifted dramatically to the right. But by the same token, the whole social spectrum of what you might call social politics has shifted dramatically to the left. And you see now how even the people who are, for example, who are pushing the gay marriage amendment, many, many of them say, well, but of course, civil unions, that's all right. Or they'll say, oh, but of course, but I'm not prejudiced against gays. Or, you know, it's fine with me if people should have their private lives as they wish. That represents an enormous change from the 60s and the 70s and even the 80s. So I think that the 60s revolution has been essentially consolidated on the cultural and social side. You see it also, I think, in the struggle, if you can call it that, over pornography. We had this absurd business of a huge fuss over Janet Jackson baring her breast at the Super Bowl. And, you know, great uproar, congressional resolutions, enormous fines imposed on the networks. And yet, at the same time, in the vast majority of American homes, you can flip on the TV set 11, 12 o'clock at night and watch softcore porn on Showtime and cable networks to your heart's content. And you don't see any Republicans demanding that be taken off the air, because they know the minute they did that, they would be out of office at the next election. So the culture war goes on, but it's being fought on a different territory.
What's the closest you've ever come to being at the center of the crossfire, or, you know, being a target?
Well, when I worked for Carter, I was Jimmy Carter's speechwriter. I have that profound distinction. And when I was working in the White House, the then nascent right-wing propaganda machine unearthed some of the stuff that I had written for WIN magazine that you mentioned earlier, this tiny little pacifist weekly, which I had written for during the Vietnam War. And they pulled some quotes out and plastered them all over. They went from right-wing column to right-wing column. Ronald Reagan even did a radio broadcast about them. And that's, I suppose that's the closest I came to being under that sort of sustained attack. Interestingly, it was the Carter folks just shrugged it off.
What were the quotes that were singled out?
Well, there was a quote that was singled out where I said something to the effect of that the communist victory in Vietnam was a victory for something in the human spirit, something along those lines. But what I had actually written was that the communists did not win in Vietnam. We chose to lose because we could not win that war without so violating our own principles that victory would not be worthwhile. So that therefore their victory was a triumph for our conscience. They didn't win because they beat us. They won because we would not do what we would have had to do to win that war, which would have essentially been to kill everyone in North Vietnam. So this tiny bit was this is why I didn't worry about it too much, because the quotes that were pulled out to attack me were just pretty much defined the whole idea of out of context.
Has that made you very skeptical as a journalist when you read quotes that may be out of context that are being used to, to hurt the reputation of somebody?
That sure has, and it happens over and over and over again, and it happens especially in political advertising, where to give a fake sense of documentation, you know, phrases and adjectives pulled out of editorials or speeches, and then presented as if they were the whole opinion of someone. And it can be done in so many different ways, and it's misleading. And yes, I am very skeptical of it.
My guest is Hendrik Hertzberg. He writes about politics for The New Yorker. His new book is called Politics. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Hendrik Hertzberg is my guest, and he's a staff writer and editor at The New Yorker magazine. And a collection of his articles from The New Yorker, The New Republic, where he used to be editor, and other publications are collected in his new book, Politics, Observations and Arguments, 1966 through 2004. In 1976, you became a speechwriter for President Carter. Did you have any reservations about entering mainstream politics as opposed to either being on the outside, observing and writing about it, or, you know, as opposed to being on a more, you know, liberal or radical end of politics than you would be entering mainstream politics and writing for the president?
I didn't have any doubts about that. Politics is political politics, you might say, and literary politics are different animals, but they're complementary. In our political system, it all comes down to two coalitions, to a coalition that's sort of center-left and a coalition that's sort of center-right. And that's the way the game is played. And compromise is absolutely inherent in politics, in American politics, perhaps even more than some other kinds of democratic politics, because we only have the two parties, which are big coalitions. I didn't have a problem going into the White House and making the compromises that I had to make. They were political compromises. They were never compromises of conscience, really. One thing that happened when I worked for Jimmy Carter is that I often disagreed with his policies. And I was always waiting for the moment to come when I would have a crisis of conscience. I know that many people who worked for Lyndon Johnson had that kind of a crisis over the war in Vietnam and the invasion of the Dominican Republic. With Jimmy Carter, who was in many ways a failed president, there was an awful lot wrong with him. Not all of his policies were what I would have hoped they would have been, but there was never a problem of conscience for me working for Jimmy Carter. I never had a troubled conscience. And that made working for him a kind of uplifting experience in the end.
You write a little bit about the unusual relationship between speechwriter and the politician the speechwriter is writing for. Can you talk about that a little bit, the unusual aspects on both sides of that relationship?
It is an uncomfortable relationship, maybe one of the more uncomfortable ones that a politician gets into. When you the main thing politicians do is talk. And if somebody else is writing what the politician says, well, who's the politician anyway? All the other members of a president's staff or a politician's staff kind of add to his glory and build him up. You know, he's got the coat holders and the guards and the assistants whispering in his ear. They all add to his allure and his greatness. But the person who's writing what he's saying, that's almost a shameful relationship. He should be, shouldn't he be thinking up his own thoughts? Who is he if he's got somebody else thinking his thoughts and writing his words? So it's always an uncomfortable relationship. And in fact, the whole idea of a speechwriter was kept under wraps until relatively recently. It was only under Richard Nixon that there began that the title speechwriter began to be used in the White House. The people who wrote president's speeches were always concealed in one way or another. In fact, the first White House speechwriter, Judson Welliver, who worked for Warren G. Harding, his salary was hidden in the budget of the White House garage.
That's how embarrassed they were to have a speechwriter.
Indeed. And FDR's speechwriters were, you know, they were people who, there was Robert Sherwood, who was a playwright, and Judge Rosenman, JFK's Sorensen. They were usually people with a broader role than just writing speeches. The presidency has grown and metastasized into it, this kind of enormous thing that's bigger than the entire federal bureaucracy was a century ago. It's gotten more and more specialized, and now you have people who have the ridiculous Gilbert and Sullivan title of speechwriter to the president.
No, President Carter was not famous for being like a riveting speaker.
Indeed.
What were some of the frustrations that you faced writing for him, knowing that he wasn't going to electrify an audience with his oratorical style?
It was less frustrating than you might imagine. It's true that Carter usually did not electrify an audience, although when he wanted to and when he had to, he could do it. When he set his mind to it, he could do it, but he generally didn't bother setting his mind to it. However, he was president of the United States, and people pay attention to you when you're president of the United States. And they pay attention to your words when you're saying them, and then they pay attention to them after you've said them.
Do you have a favorite speech or a favorite phrase that you wrote for the president?
Yeah, I have a few. I have, in a funny way, my favorite speech, which I can't claim that I wrote exactly, is the notorious, famous Melez speech, which is probably the most famous speech Carter delivered. It was after... it was at one of the low points of his presidency when there were long, long gasoline lines where he'd already announced two or three different energy programs. He scheduled another speech, then canceled it, then had a kind of domestic summit up at Camp David where he brought people up there to criticize him, to critique how he'd been leading the country and the administration. He had kind of a two or three-week session up there with various people coming in to tell him what was wrong with him. And then he came down from the mountain and gave a speech, which became known as the Melez speech, and was broadly attacked as saying that it was all the American people's fault. Well, that's not what the speech said. The speech really was a piece of excoriating self-criticism, the first third of it. The second third of it was an analysis of the crisis of confidence that the country was in, a long-term crisis of confidence rooted in the Vietnam War and in Watergate and in the loss of faith in our institutions. And then the third part was a discussion of how, by tackling the energy problem, we could begin to pull ourselves out of this crisis of confidence. The word Melez was never used. But the speech is still well worth reading. In the end, it was a failure, I have to say, because although Carter, I think, correctly diagnosed what was ailing the country, he didn't really have a solution for it. And a president should really not bring up a problem that he doesn't have a solution for. But if you read that speech today, it's an extraordinary diagnosis of where the country was then and continues to be in many ways. And
was the diagnosis Carter, something that Carter came up with and you wrote?
Carter and Patrick Cadell and a number of the intellectuals that Carter invited up to Camp David came up with it. Carter himself wrote the first third of the speech, which consisted mostly of criticisms of his own leadership, where he had taken notes on what people had told him. You know, you're not inspiring the country, you're just administering it. A lot of extraordinarily critical things that he then repeated. He was trying for a rebirth. It was a kind of attempt at a political version of his born-again religious experience, confession and redemption and rebirth. He was, in the end, though, I think he was kind of like John the Baptist and the savior of his kind of democratic politics. Big D democratic politics turned out to be Bill Clinton in the end.
So what did you learn about speech writing from writing that speech, which you thought was a good speech, but it failed?
Well, when a president speaks, you can't do it all with the talking. A president must act as well. And you can have the most wonderful speech in the world, and unless it's accompanied by effective action, it will not be memorable. You know, I once, in a talk to the Judson Wilbur Society, this is a group of White House speechwriters, past and present, I talked about how Judson Wilbur, the original White House speechwriter under Harding, was the patron saint of the unquotables. It happens that Judson Wilbur and Warren Harding came up with a lot of really memorable phrases. He was the one who coined the phrase "Founding Fathers," for example. Mm-hmm. That's one of the more memorable phrases any president or any president speechwriter has ever come up with. But nobody quotes Harding, because to say in the inimitable, immortal words of Warren G. Harding, well, stop right there. It doesn't really matter how eloquent what follows is.
Hendrik Hertzberg writes about politics for The New Yorker. His new book is called Politics. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by TIAA Craft, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide, TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, more with journalist Hendrik Hertzberg. Also, Milo Miles reviews the music of The Executioners, a group of hip-hop DJs out of New York. Their new CD is called Revolutions.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Hendrik Hertzberg. He writes about politics for The New Yorker. He's been a journalist since the 60s, but briefly left journalism to become President Carter's chief speechwriter. Hertzberg's new book, Politics, Observations and Arguments, collects his writing from 1966 to 2004. During much of the 1980s, you were at The New Republic, where you were an editor. And so, you leave the White House because Reagan wins the election, Carter leaves, you leave, and now you're covering politics again. How did it influence your coverage of politics to have been so close to the president who was defeated by the president in the White House when you were covering politics again?
Well, I think the main effect it had on me was that it had given me an education in how politics really works at this highest level, and how much more it is like everything else than we imagine it to be. I mean, we have a kind of fantasy that things are different in the corridors of power and at the heights of things. That there's up there, there's somebody who's going to take care of us. Actually, the White House is just like your office. You know, it's just like anybody
Don't
else's
say that.
Office. It is. I'm afraid it's true. It's the only difference is that everything you do is in the paper the next day, which is a lot of fun, or a big horror show, depending on what's going on. But things are almost always less intentional than you imagine they're going to be. Conspiracies are much harder to pull off and maintain. People are generally better motivated than you imagine them to be. I mean, not always, but generally speaking. Now, you may say, well, you've drawn all these conclusions from the Carter White House, and maybe they don't apply to the rest. But I've talked to an awful lot of people from an awful lot of White Houses, and I think that while the Carter White House may have been a little bit heavier on the good intentions than some of the others, and a little bit lighter on the Machiavellian ruthlessness, essentially, on a human level, they're all pretty much the same. And that knowledge does color the way you cover politics. It's more that had an effect on me than it was the fact that Reagan had defeated my candidate. You know, that defeat was so thorough and so complete that I could never begrudge it. I never felt about Reagan the way I feel about George W. Bush, that there is something illegitimate about his presence in the White House. Reagan got there fair and square. He won that election, as Cheney would say, big time. I can't say that about George W. Bush, and that's why I feel more passionately, and I think a great many people who share my politics feel more passionately anti-Bush than they did anti-Reagan. It's not because they dislike Bush personally or even disagree with his policies more. It has a lot to do with the fact that he got there in a highly questionable way, in a way that was in defiance of generally accepted democratic principles. It's generally accepted that the candidate with the most votes generally gets to have the office. When the candidate with the most votes does not get to have the office and the candidate with the second most votes gets the office, constitution or no constitution, there's something wrong with that from a point of view of democracy.
Well, there is the Electoral College.
Yeah, there is the Electoral College, a product of certain 18th century compromises that had to be reached in order to get the Constitution signed. You know, the Constitution was a product of hard political negotiations. One reason that the Electoral College is the way it is because the small states, they would not go along. It was a deal breaker for them that they would have to have equal representation in the Senate. You know, Madison was passionately against the idea that each state should have two senators. He thought that the states should have senators, the number of senators according to their population. But it was a deal breaker for the small states. And then the Electoral College was cobbled together at the last moment. You know, for the first several drafts of the Constitution, the president was going to be elected by Congress. There wasn't even going to be any involvement of the voters. And there still isn't in the Constitution any involvement in the voters. It's left to the states. to decide. If a state decides that their legislature is going to pick the presidential electors, that's within that's constitutional. People have no right to vote for president. That right has accumulated over decades as democracy grew globally. And I think that we still underestimate the degree to which the 2000 election was a radical break in more than in a century and more of progress toward democracy in this country. It was a radical break in that. And simply to say that it was according to the rules of the Electoral College doesn't change that.
Well, you know, you write in your book that you remain bitter about the election of 2000. The Secretary of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge, has said that he thinks we should consider postponing the presidential election this year if there is a terrorist attack just before it. How do you interpret that? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't understand why he thinks it's a good idea to discuss this publicly right now. It's certainly part of his responsibility to think about that question. I mean, what would we do if there were an enormous terrorist attack on election day or the day before the election? What would we do? That's a legitimate question. But simply to put this out there as a scare and to suggest that somehow he, Tom Ridge, or even the Bush administration would have the exclusive right to decide whether the election was postponed or went through. I think if they're serious about this, then they should be putting together some sort of a commission drawn from both parties with representation for people who are in neither party to study this question and to be the body that makes the decision. I think one reason that this piece of news, which is alarming and it has so much resonance for people, is partly because of 2000. And so to be discussing postponing the election now, which it resonates with people, I worry, and I think a great many people worry, that the United States is becoming, in a way, you know, less European and more Latin American, more like Argentina or Brazil. And this just adds to that kind of dread. I don't think that there's a plot afoot here for the Bush people to seize power, and you know, if they see that they're behind in the polls on election day, to gin up a terrorist incident and then say, well, we got to have a government of national salvation for the next 3 years, and we can't have the luxury of an election. I don't think that's going on, and I don't think that's going to happen. But I do think that paranoia is out there, and it's not wholly unfounded.
My guest is Hendrik Hertzberg. He writes about politics for The New Yorker. His new book is called Politics. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Hendrik Hertzberg is my guest, and he's a staff writer and editor at The New Yorker magazine, and he has a new collection of articles dating back from 1966 all the way to 2004. It's called Politics, Observations and Arguments. One of the things you write in your book is this: the atmosphere of piety in American public life has become stifling. And you also say, where is it written that if you don't like religion, you are somehow disqualified from being a legitimate American? And you write, I'm pretty sure there's no such thing as God. This is a position I imagine you've had most of your adult life, that you're not a believer.
Indeed.
And has the fact that you're not a believer resonated differently professionally, personally, and politically for you over the years?
Well, I don't know. It has never really been much of a problem. Maybe it would have been if I'd gone the route of electoral politics. I mean, I wouldn't call myself a kind of militant atheist. I'm somewhere in between an agnostic and a deist. But I think that's a good old American thing to be. I mean, the nation, although we hear a lot about how the country is, it's a Christian nation and we're grounded in the Bible and all that. Actually, the founding fathers were mostly deists.
Meaning what?
Meaning that they believed in a God, but they believed in a God as a kind of prime mover who sort of set things in motion, but not the kind of God who interferes in history. You know, not a magical figure who reaches down and puts, you know, LSU ahead of Georgia State in the Gator Bowl, you know, or decides that George Bush or Al Gore should be president. Not a God who interferes in history and performs miracles on earth, but rather a creator and someone who sort of launches the laws of nature and then does not interfere. And that's the kind of God that was commonplace in the beliefs of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and most of the framers of the Constitution. And the Declaration of Independence uses deist code language when it speaks of nature and nature's gods, when it speaks of the Creator. These are deist code words in much the same way that some of George W. Bush's speeches use fundamentalists or evangelical code words. The framers use deist code words. So I think it's very firmly rooted in American history. And secularism is firmly rooted in American history. There was a big, big fight over this. This didn't happen without a struggle. At the time of the adoption of the Constitution, one of the arguments used against it by the Anti-Federalists was, hey, this doesn't mention God. This doesn't say about how God started everything. And it was no accident that the Constitution did not say that. This was fought out in the early days of the Republic. And it was fought out again around the time of the Civil War. Lincoln, too, was a deist, essentially. He had read Thomas Paine's Age of Reason as a young man. He had very much admired it. As his wife said, my husband was never a technical Christian. And there was much more scope for this kind of religious discussion. I was brought up, my mother was a Congregationalist and a Quaker. My father was a non-observant Jew. I went for a year to a prep school where I went to Bible class and chapel. I'm very familiar with religion, and I respect religion. But I do think that there should be room for all views, and that in a way there's a kind of atmosphere of stifling piety that has settled down on the country in the last 15 or 20 years.
You have a kind of complicated Vietnam draft story. And I'm going to ask you to give a very kind of concise version of that story and ask you how you feel about the fact that, you know, Vietnam draft records are still coming into play in this presidential election with, you know, President Kerry's record as a soldier and President Bush's record. You know, the question of did he show up, did he not show up, you know, did he fulfill his duty or not? So let's start with your complicated Vietnam history.
Well, during the Vietnam War, there was a kind of new generation every couple of years, and I'm on the early end of it, the older end of it. By the time the draft became an issue for me, I believed in the draft, and my whole cohort, people, most of my friends, believed in the draft. We believed that this was an equalizer. This was a way that no matter how privileged you were, no matter how wealthy you were going to go into the army, and you were going to meet people that you would never otherwise meet, and it was a kind of enforcer of equality and was a just and fair thing. So I was not against the draft per se. I was against the Vietnam War, and I went through a long period of debating what I should do about it. Should I resist, go to jail? Should I try to avoid it somehow? Because it was not that hard to avoid. You know, you could find a sympathetic psychiatrist who would certify you as being a little too nervous to be drafted, or a podiatrist who would say you had a bum foot. It wasn't that hard to avoid, but I was too much of a straight arrow for that. My choice really came down to do I go in or do I resist? And in the end, I went in, and I'm not hugely proud of what I did. I went in, I signed up for the Navy, and I knew that in the Navy, your chances of being plunked into the jungle were fairly slim. And in fact, in the Navy, you had to ask, basically. You had to ask and ask again to be put in the line of fire, which, by the way, is exactly what John Kerry did. I have the utmost admiration and respect for John Kerry and the way he handled this. I think it's absolute proof of his character. I ended up in the Navy. I went to officer candidate school. I actually asked to be sent to Vietnam at the end of Well, because again, this idea that that I wanted to share the experience of my generation, and it's not as brave as it sounds, because if as a naval officer, I would not have been assigned to probably a naval. In fact, I eventually was ordered to Vietnam after I'd been in the Navy for a year and a half, and I was ordered to Cam Ranh Bay, where I would have been stationed on a naval base in Vietnam. You know, doing some kind of administrative job. I was not going to be, it was not going to be particularly risky. It might have been just as risky to stay in New York. So it's not as if I was saying, you know, throw me into combat and make me cannon fodder. But I did ask to go to Vietnam, but instead, catch 22, I was stationed in New York City. And I ended up living in an apartment in Greenwich Village and going to an office at 90 Church Street. And I became more and more convinced of the wrongness of the Vietnam War. I was in correspondence with a couple of friends of mine who were in the Army in Vietnam. I was reading a great deal about it. I ended up becoming a conscientious objector, or at least becoming an objector. And when I was ordered to Vietnam, stating to my superiors that I was not going to go. They should have sent me when I wanted to go. So in a great anticlimax, it ended up that I went to get my teeth fixed before I was expecting to be court-martialed and jailed, and had talked to somebody who was a guard at the Portsmouth Naval Prison. And his advice to me was, if you have any dental work you need done, get it done before you go to Portsmouth, because at Portsmouth, they just pull your teeth out. So I went and had a wisdom tooth filled, or removed, I should say. It kept on bleeding. I ended up in the hospital. Well, it turned out I was... that I had a kind of blood factor deficiency. I'd been 4F unqualified from day one, and boom, the next thing you know, I was out on the street. But it was an incredibly character-building experience, you might say. And I think the draft put lots of people, everyone had to face this question, what are you going to do? At you know, at age 20, 21. And the way you answered that question tells a lot about you.
So do you use that as a lens through which to see and evaluate presidential candidates?
Absolutely, absolutely. And seen through that lens, you can rank the candidates in order, and past candidates and politicians from that generation. At the very top is John Kerry. He did not like the war. He thought it was bad policy, but he went in. He served two tours in Vietnam. He purposely put himself in harm's way. He is the sterling, state-of-the-art, top of the line. Just under him, I'd put John McCain. John McCain had fewer doubts about the war and was from a military family. His father was commander-in-chief of Naval Forces Pacific. He was fulfilling a family tradition when he went into the Navy, but he went, he served. He's very non-judgmental, by the way, about what people did. When Clinton was under attack for his choices, McCain essentially said, you know, I don't judge what people did then. Maybe if I'd been a couple of years younger, I would have done what Clinton did. I would put at the bottom of the pile somebody like Dick Cheney, who had no fewer than 5 draft deferments. And yet who was pro-war. I mean, that's just beneath contempt, in my opinion. Close to the bottom, I would put people like George W. Bush and Dan Quayle, who pulled strings to get into the National Guard so that they could have a picture of themselves in uniform to put on a campaign brochure, but who, even though they were pro the Vietnam War, very assiduously made sure that they got nowhere near the fighting. Al Gore, I'd put him pretty close to the top, too. Bill Clinton, I'd put in the middle. He, unlike Quayle or Cheney or a lot of these people. Bill Clinton wrestled with his conscience over this. He took it seriously. He would have gone in if he'd gotten a lower draft number. He would have gone in. And then he did. Then he worked in the anti-war movement. And I consider, you know, I consider Vietnam era service to be of two kinds. There's service to the war, service in the military, and then there's service in resisting and campaigning against the war. That also deserves to be honored. And one of the reasons I'm so high on Kerry is he did both.
Hendrik Hertzberg, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Terry.
Hendrik Hertzberg writes about politics for The New Yorker. His new book is called Politics, Observations and Arguments, 1966 to 2004. Coming up, music critic Milo Miles reviews the music of The Executioners, a group of hip-hop DJs. This is Fresh Air. In one form or another, the New York group of hip-hop DJs known as the Executioners has been around for more than 15 years. The three core members, Rock Rada, Rob Swift, and Total Eclipse, have become well-known exponents of turntablism, the use of sound samples and old-fashioned record manipulation to create hip-hop tracks. Music critic Milo Miles says their latest album, Revolutions, combines rhythms for the body with tricks for the head.
It's a cliché to say that hip-hop has become the new rock and roll. But recently it's begun to make an eerie sort of sense to me. Kanye West's College Dropout is the anti-education concept album Pink Floyd only dreamed of making. Mad Villain's Mad Villainy is the pot album for our times. And Nerd's Fly or Die plainly wants to be a big, loud, dumb, hard rock album. Indeed, hard rock meets hip-hop is a widespread tendency right now. But hard rock has bumped against hip-hop for a long time. Tough, thumping beats tend to flock together. When rappers Run-DMC figured this out back in 1986, they joined with Aerosmith for the landmark remake of Walk This Way. Some thought it a novelty, but the style never really went away. Big hip-hop names like the Black Eyed Peas and Outkast aren't afraid of heavy guitar whomp, but the block-rocking kicks this season come from the Executioners' Revolutions. The three DJs get it right from the start when they proclaim themselves proudly old school, home of the thick, chunky licks. Cynics might say that this hard rock turntablism grows out of not just 80s Run-DMC, but the Executioners' own 2002 hit, It's Going Down, a collaboration with rockers Linkin Park. But the Revolutions album is an improvement, at least partly because, well, it has clearer and bolder hooks than Linkin Park. There's some sex and social commentary sprinkled throughout Revolutions, but it's the tricky mixes and rhythm adventures that stick with you. I have one complaint, however. So-called skits, brief spoken scenes with sound effects, are obviously dear to the hearts of Rock Radar, Rob Swift, and DJ Total Eclipse. They've had them on every album. Skits are also a holdover from the old school, namely De La Soul's 1989 debut. But they are nothing but pro forma and wrung dry by now. Why, the Executioner's little radio spoofs even recycled De La Soul's earliest ideas. We need one more revolution. Ditch the skits. In all other respects, the Executioners are spinning far ahead of the competition.
Milo Miles lives in Cambridge. He reviewed Revolutions by the Executioners. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a song featuring the Canadian singer Susie Arioli and guitarist Jordan Officer. They were our guests a couple of years ago. They have a new CD called That's For Me. Here's their version of You Don't Know Me.
You give your hand to me, and then you say hello, and I can hardly speak. My heart is beating so, and anyone can tell. You think you know me well, but you don't know me. No, you don't know the one who dreams of you at night and longs to kiss your lips and longs to hold you tight. Just afraid, that's all I've ever been, 'cause you don't know me. For I never knew the art of making.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Stephen Moore, president of the Club for Growth, a PAC that supports Republican candidates who favor tax cuts and tries to defeat Republicans who oppose cuts. The group also sponsored the ad that described the Howard Dean primary campaign as a tax-hiking, latte-drinking, Volvo-driving, left-wing freak show. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.